Johnson devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by John Nicholson, a retired Racine Unified administrator, Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconser, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, and Chuck Wolbers, a transition and work experience teacher in the special education department at Tremper High School, also in Kenosha. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning. My name is Mike Keogh, and welcome to Education Matters. I'm one of the rotating hosts on Education Matters, and I'm here today and really pleased to be here today with my friend Mike Falkowski, having Mike as my guest. Mike's the newest member of the board of the Kenosha Unified School District, and the man who has taken the phrase work ethic and giving it a whole new dimension. And for the next 45 minutes, you'll get the perspective of a new member of the board. And Mike, the last time you and I were in the studio together, there was an election, and there were six of us running for three or four offices. I can't remember. There were like 12 people here, and we were given 90 seconds to respond to each question, and each question, most of them were longer than 90 seconds.
Yep.
The two of us wanted to get together for a casual conversation of issues having to do with the school district, and your election makes the perfect opportunity to do that.
Great. Mike, before we get started, I'd like to just read a little disclaimer about my views and opinions. So I'd just like to state that although I am a member of the school board, the views and opinions expressed by me do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Kenosha Unified School District or the Kenosha Unified School District Board of Education. These thoughts are my own. Just wanted to put that out there.
Sure. That's that's very understandable. So you're joining the board at a time and a place where if you look back, you see a period of a couple of years of dissension on the board, a number of issues being dumped into the educational support center and the schools from outside that nobody had an ability to plan for, or in some cases even a reason to suspect. And you have a you look forward and you see a future filled with lots of serious issues, especially the budget coming out of Madison, which seems to be rolling at a steamroller pace. I'm wondering what you see coming. And at this point in your career with the school board, what you see happening? What's your perspective?
What I've seen, looking at the budget, obviously, you know, I've only been on the board a few weeks, so the board and the administration have been looking at these numbers, anticipating the worst-case scenario that the categorical aid, that per-pupil aid, will not be restored. And right now, actually, to a little bit to my surprise, the administration is going to take the bulk of that hit. Almost, you know, they're planning to take the majority of that, and we're going to keep the class size for the most part without firing too much on – or not – without – eliminating too many staff positions. The ones that we do are going to be through retirement and through the one-year contracts that we have. So I'm actually feeling better about this, because I was really concerned that was going to impact the classroom size that we might have to, that they might be looking at getting rid of a few teachers. So I was pleasantly surprised to see administration willing to take it on the chin, because I believe that's a lot different than the previous superintendent would have done.
Yes, I would probably agree with that, and I would have another comment about that, and that is, you know, I've never seen anybody run for a position on a school board with the kind of strategy and energy that you did over the last two elections, particularly the election that you didn't win. Thinking about that for a moment, you went door to door every night.
Yep.
And you did it for a long period of time, and you didn't give a 3-minute speech and hand somebody literature and walk away. And whether they agreed with you or not, I know because I've seen it, that you stayed and talked to those folks and heard what they had to say. And I would think that would put you in a position where you would be uniquely qualified to look at the kinds of problems that we're going to be facing.
Yes, I agree. I mean, whenever I go on any endeavor or take on anything, I always show 150% effort. It's just, you know, I think I call it the Midwestern work ethic that we're all kind of trained to work hard. And I realized, you know, especially the first year, that I was a known name with a lot of people. I wasn't well recognized in the community. So I had to get out there. I had to get my name out there and door to door and talking to people and respecting people. That's the most important thing, is to actually respect people's opinion, because we all have different ideas on things. And being on the school board, I mean, as we can see, there's already a variety of opinions on there, and you have to be willing to listen to everybody, because not every point is 100% valid, but there's usually kernels of validity inside those truth and inside those opinions. And by me going out to the community and listening to the criticism, it helped me understand how parents were seeing it. It helped me understand how, you know, people who didn't have kids in the district saw the district and what kind of changes, and some of the misconceptions that are out there, especially about, you know, teachers and teachers being overpaid and things like that. When some of the communication that we're not having out there showing understanding how hard the staff actually works inside these schools, how many hours they're actually put in, and all the different things that, you know, the staff deal with.
Yeah, in my position as a volunteer support person with in special ed, I'm in the school a lot. Mostly Bullen is where I spend my time, and I've really been impressed with how different things are than they were a couple of years ago when I was a substitute teacher, nearly full-time substitute teacher, with the commitment of the teachers, and their willingness to put up with a lot of things, because there seems to be a feeling of hope that things are going to get better. I also would have the observation in connection with that what seems to be happening from my perspective with the board and administration is something is happening sort of akin to when Dwight Eisenhower became president.
Okay.
There seems to be a recognition that this board needs some peace and quiet and some contemplation to deal with some things, and that everybody, regardless of where they stand, seems committed to that.
Yes. There are, you know, some undercurrents, some friction on the board, as there's going to be the group of people. But in general, the board is trying to work together, do the best things for the district, to, you know, especially looking forward to the new strategic plan that we're putting out there, and making sure that we use the audit as kind of the baseline, because we spent a lot of money on this audit that showed us a lot of the things that we could do better in the district, such as centralizing curriculum, training, and just making the organization run more efficiently. And that goes into my job. That's one of the reasons I ran for school board, is I wanted to help guide the district in running more efficiently and looking at how we can use technology, how we can work together collaboratively, how maybe we can work with other school districts, like with the CESA districts and things like that. So, but yeah, generally, you know, in spite of what you might see sometimes in the paper, I think the board is trying to do its best to work together.
One of the things I've found in the time that I've been involved with education is that there are, do you know what a TLA is?
Yes.
A three-letter acronym? That there are more three-letter and four-letter acronyms in education than there are in the military.
Yes.
What is a CESA?
Cooperative Education Service Association, I think.
Okay.
There's like nine across the state. I may have that wrong, but basically it's school districts working together in different districts across the state to collaborate, mostly among the superintendents, to collaborate and spread standards and ideas, and, you know, how we're going to work, or how they're going to work with Common Core and different things, and just sharing ideas. So it's a great way of promoting ideas throughout the state and collaboration, which is important, because, you know, Kenosha can't solve all its problems by itself. We need to look. We're sitting in a state level and a national level bowl of soup, right? And we have to look to others sometimes to, like, how are you dealing with this? And then when and vice versa, we can give them advice on things that we're working with.
Yeah, is that system being energized by the avalanche of problems that are coming down the road?
I don't know if it's energized. They're working with it. You know, I don't know if it's energized, but I mean, they've seen this coming. You know, they've been on top of this for, you know, since it started or before. You know, they kind of sense the trend since the election.
Okay, well, we were mentioning that you mentioned the strategic plan and the audit and the budget that we mentioned, the state budget that is day by day is kind of taking its own form. It's developing its own momentum. And to get your perspective on that, where would you like to start with the?
Well, you know, one thing about the state budget I'd like to see differently is right now, you know, the aid that's being taken away is, or they're talking about, is a categorical aid, the per pupil. If we would just put that, I think we'd show a better commitment if we would just restore that back to the equalized aid that the district used to get, you know, that the big cut we took under Act 10 a couple of years. I think just putting that $150 or restoring the actual $500 that was taken per student back would show a better commitment than just doing this categorical aid. I understand they have this because it gives them flexibility in the budget, but if they really wanted to show us that they were committed to education, I think they would restore it inside the equalized aid, just my opinion.
One of the things that's impressed me about the way that it's coming down is I don't know if I would I can't make up my mind whether it's foolish or whether it's very cynically planned out, but so many different groups in the field of education, from K through 12 all the way through college and university, are facing big cuts at the same time, and it seems as if they're being put in a position where they would be tempted to compete with one another for funding. So far, I don't think I've seen that they've been willing to they've been falling into that trap.
Well, that's kind of natural, isn't it? If you're losing funding, you're going to try to get it back for your group as quickly as you can and, you know, forget the rest of the groups, right? So mm-hmm. you're going to focus on what concerns you the most. So if you're, you know, K through 12, you're going to focus on that. If you're the university, the supporters of that are going to try to take that. Personally, I think it's a bit foolish to take money away from the university. It generates money for the state. You know, when we hurt the university system, I think we might be hurting, you know, especially the economies in Milwaukee and Madison, which are, you know, driven by technology and the different things that come out of those university systems.
And the K through 12 systems feed the university system.
Yes.
They provide most of the pupils, but the university system also fulfills the dream that the K through 12 system is trying to create by providing a foundation education for young people that
right.
they'll be able to follow through into the future. And while we're sitting here at Gateway, that's a little bit off to one side, but that also is part of the same track.
We know Gateway and the local technical and community colleges play a vital role because not every student wants to go to college. Some are better off, you know, learning a trade. That's just more their knack in life. They like to work with their hands, or they want to get right out in the work. You know, not everybody wants to spend five more years in school. Some people would rather just spend 1 or 2 years and then jump into a career and you know, and just keep taking additional training throughout their life to improve their career skills. So I think it's important that we have these other schools as well as just not just the university system.
Something that's impressed me has been the extent of the cooperation that has occurred between Kenosha Unified and Gateway,
yes.
Particularly with Lakeview Tech,
definitely, yep.
Which I substituted out there off and on for 10 years, and the transformations that I've seen taking place have been enormous, and it seems to me that that's been a tremendous asset to this community with the economic problems that we've been facing, and we're just beginning to get out.
Yeah, and that shows how the school district working with Gateway or other community organizations can bring additional value by creating collaboration with having students get out and see, you know, actually touch and work with the technology at Lakeview, or get out and work with mentors, or even, you know, just with the youth option programs where you can actually go to, you know, college credits and things like that. It's all important things to get students ready for their future, so there's not just graduate high school, now what? You've already started the track. You kind of got your getting a firm idea of what you want to do in life, and you're ready to go. You're, I don't want to say career ready, but you're more focused than maybe so like I was when I came out of high school and I was just going to college.
Yeah, that reminds me of a friend of mine in Colorado. Their daughter graduated last year with a degree in English and a certificate as an English teacher, and planted a big sign in the front yard, said, English teacher will teach for gasoline.
That's a shame.
We've got two things then. We've got the problems that are going to come as a result of the budget, which we are gradually becoming aware of.
Right.
And then we have the problems that were delineated in the audit that we have some awareness of. And the school board and administration are going to have to adapt to that and decide how they can use their facilities to cope with that. How is the strategic planning plan? I guess is I would assume is going to be in a it's something that's in process, and it's going to be in process. And maybe you could tell us something about how that's going on.
Well, right now there's been the school board and administration met back in February, and they put the foundation, which was the mission statement and the vision. And these are just drafts. These aren't set in stone yet. And then they put down five core values, which are in the slides I gave you there. And what we're going to do now is we're going to – they're showing this to the staff currently. But now we're going to roll it out to the community, and we're going to present this to the community so you can get some feedback. Now, unfortunately, I've heard from people in the community, well, I don't want to go see that because I went to the transformation committees and, you know, it didn't work. And that the things that we brought up weren't using the transformation plan and, you know, and all that complaining. But I want to stress that I hope people go to these meetings. I think this is important. This is, give the district a second chance here. Let's look at the strategic plan. I think Dr. Sue and the school board really want the community to be involved. They're really going to want their input. Just from, you know, my talking with the school board president, Ms. Coleman, and with Dr. Sue, that we want to see the community there. We want to hear your input on what we put out for the mission statement and the vision. We want to see if you agree with us or what the community thinks would be better. And there's going to be a couple opportunities in early June. I have some dates here where you can actually go see these. These are going to be put on flyers and put out to the public in a couple weeks here. But for those listening to the show, they can get a heads up so they can put these on their calendar. If you wish to see the strategic plan, we will have a showing on Tuesday, June 2nd, 5:30 at the ESC. Wednesday, June 3rd at 5:30 at the ESC. And then Thursday, June 4th, 5:30. I don't have the correct location here. I think it's Indian Trail, but I could be wrong about that. But the first two are at the ESC. And I really hope the community gets out there. This is, you know, we're reaching out to you. We want you guys to come and give us your opinion. And that's the only way the strategic plan, I think, is really going to work, is if we create something in collaboration with the parents and the business leaders and, you know, the local colleges, that we get the whole community involved, and so everybody understands what we're trying to do and where we want to go with the district in 5 years. You know, it's not just the district by itself. It's training the future business leaders, training the future leaders and economic powerhouses of our community here. So I really hope the community will help us out here with their input.
I would think that would be essential in sort of as we were alluding to sometime before, there are going to be some limited resources, but we're all in the same boat.
Right.
And the worst thing we could possibly do, regardless of what our kids maybe have some special interest in or what kind of programs we support, the worst thing we can do is start cannibalizing.
Right. Yeah. Right. We don't want to do that. We have to. I think the district has to be more creative sometimes. Like we talked about with the going out with the partnerships, with the way they spend the money. I mean, I think there's room to do things differently inside the district. Just you have to think how technology is coming down. One example I talked about during the election was, you know, using more webinars, and, you know, people told me it only saves a little bit here and there. It's like, well, it's not the point of saving this year. It's about the future savings. It's about making things more efficient so the district uses its resources wisely, not just this year, but 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road. That's really what we're looking at, is what we can do to make, at least, you know, I'm looking at what we can do to make the district run, you know, with the same, you know, because I think, you know, with what we have in Madison, we're not going to see a lot of increase in spending, so we're going to have to, or money from the state, we're going to have to get used to doing more if less, as we say in local government, where, you know, where I come from.
Well, and to have things thrust upon you suddenly forces you to be in a situation where it's very difficult to develop a long-range plan and to be fair to everyone.
Right.
And not just, take money from programs that don't have as much support or awareness from the public as maybe some others, but are equally important.
And that's where communication is important. On a sidetrack from the last election, we were at a forum where we were talking about the charter schools and why there may not be as much diversity in the charter schools as we would like, and it came down to communication. We all four candidates agreed it came down to communication again. It's making sure that we get the information out to all the parents and that they understand how to fill the forms out, how the lottery works. And it's the same here with these programs. We have to make sure that parents know about these programs, that these opportunities are there. I mean, there may be lack of interest just because there's lack of knowledge of them. And so just putting it out in newsletters, social media, we have millions of ways to put things out there that we can make parents aware. So the best way, if schools have PTAs and PTOs, is putting out through there, because that gets into the newsletters, and a lot of parents get those, you know, in the little folders that come home with their kids every.
Yeah, one of the things I want to try and do during my tenure on this program is to provide some focus on some of the things that are beyond the 3 R's that the general public may not be aware of.
Yeah.
For instance, last month we did a program on the dual language program, which is something I like a lot. And I know that you have always been a champion of these kinds of programs on both ends of the spectrum, both special education programs and especially advanced placement programs.
Right.
Maybe you'd like to speak to that.
Sure. You know, that's why my slogan always was excellent for all students. I want to make sure that all students are being challenged. One of the things I like that the district's doing now is they're looking at their gifted and talented program. They have another ad hoc committee that's meeting about mm-hmm. that. Because as we know, that there's a gap. We have a magnet at Roosevelt, so we kind of accelerate kids up through grade 5, but then we don't really have many options in middle school except for specialized programs for parents, you know, to set their own differentiated education plan, or, you know, to be unless they're proactive. Otherwise, those kids kind of sit there. There's a couple honors, you know, honors math and English, but there's actually no honors at all in sixth grade. And then we jump into high school where you have advanced placement and honors again. So getting honors back into the middle school, which I believe is what this committee, part of what this committee is going to look at. They're looking at the whole thing, you know, how do we encourage and develop gifted and talented students. But on the other end, too, with the special needs students, I think, it goes back to the money, but we could definitely use more staff there to help work with the special needs students so that they got more of the one-on-one attention they need. Because some of those students just require more hands-on because they have, you know, some challenges that they need help overcoming. And and really, I like to see the district more as a partner. A lot of times I hear from parents that they feel like the district is against them when it comes to, you know, they'll put the IEP together fine, but then they feel like the parent feels that they try to challenge IEP saying it's not being followed, then the district gets kind of defensive, which is unfortunate that the parent feels that way. It should be a partnership. You know, maybe the IEP isn't being followed, but it should just admit that what happened and try to fix it and move forward from there. Because no one's perfect, right? We make mistakes. We may not follow something exactly. Just admit that something that didn't go the way we planned and start over again, you know, and make sure we're getting the best outcome for those students. Because we talk about achievement gaps, right? One of the biggest ones is between the special needs students and the regular population. If you look at the DPI page side, I mean.
Right. I was thinking, as you said that, of one of the issues that was brought up in our last program here, where we had some people, some kids who had graduated from Kenosha dual language and were now in college or out in the workforce. And one of the things they said, they were extremely happy with the program. They said one of the problems they had was when they got out of middle school and got to high school,
yep.
they were more advanced than some of the kids who had been taking foreign language for a couple of years in high school.
Sure.
And for a while, there was a plateau for them.
And that's definitely unfortunate. You know, we should be able to keep going so that they can learn Spanish to the level that they're capable of. If that's beyond, you know, if we have to get them in the college course or bring that level of instruction, then we should. That's all part of it. That was one of the things the transformation plan, remember, differentiated education, that would be one of the things that we would try to do. Now, again, I know it's a money thing, you know. And the fact that, unfortunately, the fact that we kind of pared back our foreign languages here in the district where German, you know, is only offered at one school as opposed to both. And the other thing, you know, Spanish is the primary second language, but we also have a variety of other second language learners that more than just Spanish. There's a lot of, you know, African languages and some Eastern European languages as well that we have to, you know, make sure we're providing for those students as well.
Yeah, that in the last couple of years, changes that the previous administration proposed to and started to implement with respect to foreign language was really controversial. Do you think that the board and the district are on a track now that is going to be more popular or more effective?
I think so. I think we all kind of realize now that maybe learning foreign language on a computer isn't as effective as we
yes.
think. With the Rosetta Stone, you know, thing in elementary school that unfortunately didn't work out. But so I think we all would like to see more world languages at the high school level and if possible into the middle school. But how we get there again, I don't know that path. But that's something I would like to see, and I would definitely be interested in pursuing.
Yeah, Rosetta Stone, I don't think was – I think it grows out of a Department of Defense program that was developed at the Presidio in California and was never intended to be a substitute for conversational learning.
Right.
They would put people in cohorts, and they would learn partly from the computer, but they would also have classes, and they would be together in,
right.
in settings and restaurants and things like that, so that you can. I had 4 years of German in college, and had a couple of German exchange students, but although I can still read it,
right.
I can't speak it. If I was in Germany and wanted to ask directions to the bathroom, I would have to sit and think.
Right, and then that's a good point. I mean, you just it's more effective to teach foreign language with an actual person or a teacher than through the technology. I took 2 years of French, you know, in college myself, so I can sort of, I can only sort of read it, but I wouldn't even try to speak it.
Yeah. One of the experiences I had with, this was a universal experience, both as a host for exchange students and as a coordinator for the EF program here for a couple of years, is that both the students and their parents were astonished when they came here and found out that a foreign language was not mandatory.
Right.
Because in Europe, foreign language is mandatory starting something like second or third grade.
Yeah. And I think that would be something that would benefit our students if we pushed that here as well. There's just, we live in a global economy, and being able to communicate in more than one language is going to be vital, especially, you know, in Spanish or in Mandarin, just if you plan to be a business person or if you plan to travel. So I'd like to, I think, what I remember about foreign language, too, is it just gets you, when I took French, it wasn't just learning French. You learned about the French culture. You
got
to, that's really what's beneficial.
Your background is geography, right? Your
yes.
academic background. My undergraduate background was in political science and history, and I had a double major, but that involved a lot of language. I mean, a lot of geography. My first exchange student came here as a senior. He was with me for his senior year at Tremper. And he was taking what I would assume was an advanced placement course in social studies. And in the first week or two, one of the things that the teacher did to get a handle with his class and show them what they needed to learn was he gave them a fairly large size map of the United States, not just a single page map.
Right.
And they were asked to identify each of the states and write the names of the states in, and then they were all graded. And Gabby came home from school one day, and he said, "This is you won't believe this, Mike." He said, "This is really funny." He said, "I was the only one who got 100%."
Oh, wow!
And the next person. Who the next highest student in the class had 13 wrong.
It doesn't surprise me too much, actually. You know, geography is, you know, it's not taught. There was an interesting editorial in the paper on Sunday about, you know, the lack of geography or being taught in school and how it's just kind of rolled into social studies, which is important to learn, you know, the cultures with that. But just my concern, you know, my passion is to try to get people to understand more about geography, because it's important to understand what's going on in the Middle East. It's important to understand what's going on in Eastern Europe. You have to understand, A, the history, and you have to understand why people are there. You know, we're going back to the Middle East, understanding the Sunni versus the Shiite Muslims, and why you have conflict lines and how people ended up where they were, and how a lot of those things are just because those countries were previously colonies, and those are just, some of those are just arbitrary lines that just went down right between tribes, and so now we have...
Yeah, it makes you wonder sometimes if the American public was better educated in foreign cultures and in geography, if maybe some of our foreign policies might be taking somewhat of a different direction.
I think definitely, you know, if you kind of understood what we're really there for, which is a lot of times just the resources. You know, when you try to see why we care what happens in one country and not another country, when there's some of their dictatorships or revolutions, the ones that we choose to get involved in and the ones that we kind of step to the side, a lot of times just look at what resources are there. Is it oil or some kind of iron or some kind of, you know, rare earth minerals? That's usually why we seem to be more interested. That's always a fascinating thing when you follow the news and you understand the geography and you can see why we step into Iraq or not so much into Syria, you know, and how Syria actually still, believe, I don't know if you know this, Syria actually still has a Russian naval base that they lease to the Russians. That's why the Russians are involved in Syria.
I know that one of the problems with regard to Syria that the general public is not aware of is that Russia has always considered that northern tier of Arabic and Muslim states, including Syria, to be part of their sphere of influence.
Right.
And so that's why us supplying weapons, for example, would be something that would really be something significant and that a lot of people would be upset about in that area,
right,
where we would see it just as a normal concerned thing, thing to do. But well, we don't want to get off on...
So getting back to education.
Yes. This is what happens to us every time we talk on the phone. We
exactly.
go from one thing to another. But what they all generally have to do with education. Are there any concerns that you have in particular about things that might come out of Madison that might threaten some things that you feel strongly about here in Kenosha?
I don't strongly, but I am just concerned about what we're doing with Common Core. You know, I've always supported the standards and having a national standards because we move around so much and people move around so much. It's important, I think, that people are learning similar things in Kenosha and Madison and, you know, Tallahassee, Florida. But I wish there was a way to not have so much standardized testing and not to use that standardized testing as a way to punish schools who are underperforming, because I don't see how taking resources from schools who are underperforming helps those schools. And the other thing that concerns me is the push to privatize things, especially the 2RCs, which are, you know, where they're going to expand what organizations can form charter schools right now. I don't know if it's a comprehensive list, but I think it's the city of Milwaukee, MATC, and Parkside are the only places that can organize private charters. Now they're going
to... Can give private... UWM.
Okay, yeah.
They have one school.
and I want to be clear, I'm not against private schools. I think we have some good ones here in Canola. St. Joseph's or All Saints is a good example of how, you know, private schools can work. I'm just concerned for-profit models coming in where, as we've seen in Milwaukee, sometimes they work, but we also hear a lot of cases where they're kind of a fly-by-night thing. They go, they fail, they disappear, and, you know, they take the money with them. And then you hear the horror stories of, you know, the transcripts are gone. These kids don't even have any records of their grades or the, you know, what they've done over the last 6-7 years because that school's gone, and now they have to prove what they learned and what they've taken. So that's really my biggest concern. I ran for the school board because I believe in public education. I'm a big supporter of public education. I think we should spend the money in one spot. I don't see how splitting it into several pots is going to help anything. We should, you know, I think stay focused on fixing our public schools. And really, this isn't really about Madison, but I think generally as a culture, we have to think differently about schools. We just have to be a little more open to how we change them and doing different things with them. Not necessarily always being just, you know, a classroom and sitting in a classroom in front of a teacher, but being a little more open to different learning styles, you know, if that makes sense what I'm saying there.
Yeah. I'm a product of both parochial Catholic Franciscan education K-8 and a public high school and 2 years, four-year degree from UWM and then law school at Marquette. So I've had the experience of both of them, and I value both of them. I've also had experience of having been in Southern schools in Alabama, and you and I both attended a program a week ago, Tuesday, I think it was, where someone from the Department of Public Instruction was down here. And one of the points that I think that came out that was kind of enlightening to me and gave me some hope was the concept that the voucher school program, as it is set up and it is as it is planned to be expanded, would penalize both parochial religious schools and public schools. We both stand to lose because it will be opening the door to private schools, private entrepreneurs, whose interest is going to be financial.
Yes.
And that's where you get some of the problem schools that we've seen in Milwaukee that have had to close, or where people have embezzled money, or the students haven't been given the education that they were promised.
And, you know, they couple that with that they want to lower the qualifications of people who can teach at a school, and they want to use five different sets of standards possibly that the judge schools to make it more confusing to see how schools, in my opinion, be more confusing to see how schools measure up. It just gets really scary about how much accountability there'll be on these private schools. We know their bottom line is going to be, you know, making a profit. It's what a private organization is supposed to do. But really, education should be about educating. It should be about developing the best students and pulling out all we can from students, getting them excited about learning. As you know, we're both lifelong learners. They should learn how to be a lifelong learner, how to always ask questions, how to always be thinking critically. Does this make sense? Comparable against what I know. Do I need more information? Where can I get that information from? Who should I talk to? What research should I do? We got to get, you know, with this new economy, the new way that things are working with millions of pieces of information, you know, 999,000 of it incorrect, having to filter that. It's just important. And that's one of the things I have against standardized testing is I think it takes away from the time to build creative and critical thinking that come from creative thinking, from doing arts, from doing music, from being able to explore with your hands.
This semester, this year, were very difficult for the schools to do the testing because we had the testing that had to go on in the schools to give students their grades. And then we had the Badger test, and we had another test that was required by the feds and so on, and it was a major disruption. It just was a number of things that weren't horseshoed well together. Under the plan that's proposed, private schools, these for-profit schools, would not be held to the same standards as others simply because they'd be given different tests.
Right. And that's what doesn't make it fair, because then how do we know that they're performing as well as a public school? The whole point of having these private schools, right, is that they are going to perform better. You know, what I find interesting, you know, is performance is kind of relevant. People say that the charter schools here in Kenosha perform better, and it's because they have better staff or curriculum, whatever. That's not necessarily the case. What the charter schools have here is because the parents want to be there. They have more heavily parent involvement, so that parents more up on what their kids are doing and pushing their kids and making sure that the kids are getting things done and participating in the schools and being part of the carnivals or the after-school activities. You know, so you really, there's so many factors that go into how a school performs. You just can't say it's because staff or because the way the school is run. There's millions right. of outside factors. If we could do a whole other show on on those outside factors.
Yeah, maybe my attitude is a bit slanted, but from my experience in the South, I can't think of vouchers without looking around for political motives. Because when my sister was in high school in Alabama, they went to a voucher system in order to try and enable white students to go to school separately from the black students.
Oh, wow.
And it failed. And one of the reasons it failed was it wasn't fair to rural school districts, because where were the people in the small Alabama towns and the small towns in Wisconsin are the strength of the Republican Party here?
Right.
Where were they going to find the schools to use those vouchers for?
Right, and that's just the same issue they're still going to have. The only thing I could think of is if they set up, you know, virtual online schools. I mean, they still need a physical location to go to do your gym credits and things, but you can handle some of that through there. But I agree that some of these changes are really going to hurt the rural schools, and especially when they made this cut to the Categorical 8, I think that's why you're seeing some of these Republic assemblymen fight back a little bit, because they're looking around and seeing right. the impact this is going to have. You know, it may only be $100,000 to a small school district, but that might mean no more athletics, no more music programs. You start telling your parents that, you're going to have a riot. You're going to have rioting in the street.
And one other thought I have on that from my attitude from having been in the South for a while, which unfortunately we aren't going to have much time to go into, is the attitude towards Common Core, as if the thought that it's targeted at Wisconsin schools. Common Core is targeted on the schools in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Arizona, and places like that, which are not living up to the teaching standards that we have here.
Right.
It's not going to hurt Wisconsin schools at all in that respect.
No.
It's designed to force those other school districts to build things up.
I think what people should understand about Common Core is it doesn't have to be the ceiling. It can be the floor. It's just you don't right. go below the standard. I think a lot of cases we do surpass those standards. But are we almost out of time here?
Yeah, sorry. I guess we're just about out of time. So we'll have to end this session of Education Matters at this point. But Mike and I will continue to have conversations like this for months into the future. I want to thank Mike Falkowski for being here today. And I enjoyed the conversation with him very much, and to our audience for listening. And I want to be sure to mention that our programs are available on the WGTD Internet Archive. If you know someone who might like to hear it, or you want to hear it again, or you want to look to see if there's some other topics, go to the WGTD website, and you'll find the programs there. And in addition, we also have a new Facebook site, so where you can look and you can find out when programs are going to be on, and you can listen to them when you have the time available. So with that, we'll close this session out, and request that you please tune in next week for another Education Matters.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. You're listening to Community Matters, a discussion of important issues facing our communities. The program is co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Troy McDonald, a Gateway marketing student who also serves as a development specialist for WGTD. Now, here's today's host.
Good morning. I'm Marlo Harmon, your host of today's Community Matters on WGTD 91.1. And today's guest is Greg Petro. He is the president of Racine Interfaith Coalition and co-chair of the 11 by 15 campaign that is also a part of Rick's project. So welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Marlo. Good morning.
Good morning. Why don't you share a little bit of information about Racine Interfaith Coalition, or RIC as we call it, and provide us some background with regards to them.